Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. And you know something? It's about aging today. You and I are aging, and actually, that in itself is a real paradigm shifting event, isn't it? Not that it's one event, but a period of events. And I have a wonderful researcher, spiritual scholar, and someone has worked with people for many, many years and his own philosophical understanding of these things and is exploring this. My guest today is Dr. Robert Weber, and you're the author of The Spirituality of Age, and what is it? A Guide to, what's the second half of the book title?
The subtitle is A Seeker's Guide to Growing Older. So, and I co-authored that with Dr. Carol Orsborn.
Right, that's wonderful. And Carol Orsborn is Dr. Carol Orsborn is of a Jewish background, and you're of a Jesuit background, but both of you are intensely philosophical and scholarly, right?
Exactly. Yeah, Carol actually has a doctorate in the history and criticism of religion, critical theory of religion, from Vanderbilt University.
Oh wow, good for her, eh? And she runs a wonderful. I think it's a newsletter called Fierce with Age.
That's correct. And she also wrote a memoir, which is entitled Fierce with Age.
Aha. Yes. Well, I think that really leads into our whole conversation today, because what you're saying in this book, you and Carol together have listed 25 different questions for people to ask themselves in order to plumb the gold out of aging and help people get through the processes of aging with great value, right?
That's it. And I think it's important to emphasize too, Veronica, that our book is not a self-help guide. It's not, you know, come to the experts and get the answers. We think that each person is his or her own expert. And the important thing is to take the questions that we pose ourselves and answer in our book, and then to create your own answers for those same questions. Be a seeker. A seeker is someone who's questing and seeking, come out of the same root, which is questioning, wondering, looking at life and saying, I don't get it right now. What is this all about? And really being patient with yourself in pursuing the questions and living your way through to an answer. Don't expect it to be handed to you. You can find it.
Well, it can be. If it's a subjective reality, it can't actually be handed to us, can it?
No, it can't. No.
Having worked with people for many, many years, I still go, I'm amazed that I'm the only one in the universe that's me. I'm like a child that way. I still go.
But Veronica, don't let it go to your head, because, you know, the truth is that there's nothing unique about uniqueness.
Well, you know, Bob, there's something else that's interesting. I was reading in your book about the word narcissism. And a lot of people I know will say, oh, so-and-so is just a narcissist. But I want you to talk to people a little bit about, because I'm very into self-inquiry, like asking myself, you know, it's all about me, that sort of thing, and finding out what I'm really here for, what I'm doing that's in or out of sync with me. But the word narcissism could fit, unfortunately, rather snugly with that, couldn't it?
It could, except it is a total preoccupation with self. The myth of Narcissus is he, in a sense, swooned to death looking at his own image in the pond.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, we can't just look at our image in the pond. I think we need to look beyond that. A healthy narcissism is not a bad thing. In fact, it's an absolutely essential part of psychological development. But at a certain point, you need to develop relationships to others beyond you and to the world beyond yourself. Otherwise, you wind up really, you know, in solitary confinement in your own narcissism. So healthy narcissism, yes. And asking questions, yes. That's a seeker. That's someone who seeks. That's what baby boomers are. You know, people born between 1946 and 1964 are referred to as baby boomers or seekers.
Hmm. Well, I'm a pre-baby boomer, so, and I've been always a seeker, so I guess there are us in different vintages
Oh,
as well.
it doesn't matter if you're, you know, that's just the sort of the name that was given to us by actually a man on the West Coast there, who's a professor at UCal San Diego, Wade Clark Roof, who wrote a book in the early 90s called A Generation of Seekers: The Spiritual Journeys of the Baby Boomer Generation. He was one of our endorsers. And he looked at, you know,
Roof. I
what are
like
the
that
stories?
name, and it's a very good metaphor for this too.
Absolutely. And he really researched as a from a sociological perspective the various journeys and where people wound up, the particular answers that people fashioned for themselves over the course of their lives. And it's a fascinating book, and then seeing the different paradigms that emerged from that book also are worth considering, and seeing where do I fit in here, you know.
So the
And
whole book and aging and all of that is actually helping people evaluate or really find ways of who am I, where do I fit into all of this? That's a really big issue in the book. At least I find it.
absolutely. And you know what's constraining to people, I think, is we look outside ourselves, and you and I have talked a little bit about this. You look outside yourself and say, what do people expect of me? What do they expect of me as a 5-year-old, as an adolescent, as a college student, as a you know, a young parent, as a now as an aging person? You know, and if we look around us, the expectations don't do us often don't do not help. You know, there's the expectation that when you get old, your job is to disengage, you know, retire, get rid of your role. Of course, when we lose our roles, we don't know who we are
I know
often.
sometimes other people's expectations are like a carving knife or a whittling knife.
Oh, we get pigeonholed, and the problem is if it were just that others try to pigeonhole us, but then we accept those perceptions of us.
Well, let's go back to the word narcissism. Then we're in a jail. We're already imprisoned.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So there's something about aging that can unlock some of those clanging doors, right?
Absolutely. If you can break out, you know, and I tell people when I work with them in therapy often, I said, our work here, and this is whether they're young or old, I say, our work here is to create, prepare for a jailbreak. Prepare for a jailbreak from the restrictions you have put on yourself, the prison you've created for yourself. As one of my patients said to me so articulately, when he finally discovered what he'd been doing to himself for over 70 years, he said, you know, he said, I realize now that all my life I've worked so hard to build a fortress, a place where I could feel safe. And what I realize now is I created a prison for myself. I
Wow.
thought it was a fortress.
And that's
And that.
so true. So, what did he do? Did he become easier with aging? What happened?
He, I think, began to make some changes in his life, in his relationship to his wife. There were some major changes that went on, and I think he began to feel freer, free of the restrictions that he had imposed on himself, which he had internalized from his own upbringing and culture. You know, that's what we do. You know, we take on the what others expect, and then we feel good about ourselves, but we don't really, because we're not
But
looking
wait,
for ourselves.
there's a thing when taking it on it. I just want to refer to what you're saying, which is you were in the Catholic mode and you were a Jesuit, which is a pretty intellectual or intelligent flow of philosophy and so on. But you also talked, and I was really grateful because I was also Catholic. But you talked about the seven deadly sins, or for example, shame. And I go, oh my gosh, we've got huge generations that are loaded with shame, which isn't necessarily who we are. And I don't think it prompts self-inquiry that much. What do you think about that?
Well, I think I talk with people a lot about shame. I've written several papers about shame because it was not just a fascinating topic, but personally relevant to me. Because, you know, when I was a kid, I think I was plagued more by what I thought was a sense of guilt. But there's a difference between guilt and shame. You know, guilt, Catholic guilt, people talk about Catholic guilt. You know, Catholic guilt, it's I did something wrong. You know, when I was a kid, I'd go to confession and say, I did this so many times, I did that so many times, and then I'd get absolution and be forgiven by the priest.
Right.
But shame is more insidious. Shame is not I did something wrong. It's a more fundamental sense of I am something wrong.
Right.
I am something wrong. And when I get older, you know, in my own aging now, I've had to confront, you know, perceptions of, you know, myself, self-perceptions and perceptions of others as I've experienced difficulties like, you know, hobbling around now with a cane awaiting a hip replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, initially I thought, what are going to people think of me? I was an athlete, you know, I people say, you don't really look good for your age. I said, appearances can be deceiving. I said, because inside there are some older parts.
But let me ask you this. Does that mean that you feel a bit of shame about having a bit of decrepitude?
Exactly. You know, I think initially, I think I experienced some sense of shame about, you know, I am getting older. It was like a realization that, you know, I am now an older man. I'm going to turn 70 in June.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, 70, it's almost hard to believe because I don't feel 70. Despite the pain of the hip, I feel like I am coming alive in ways that I never was alive even as an adolescent or a college student because I was so restricted by trying to fulfill others' expectations of me.
By what you thought you should be, right?
Well, yeah, and you mentioned my Jesuit background. You know, I think from the time I was a little boy and raised in a Catholic culture, in the culture, I think there was nothing greater than having a son who could be a priest.
Right. Okay.
That was, you know, and my dad had that dream for me. And I loved my father, so I began to dream that dream for myself, although I kept pushing it away. And he kept saying, well, take your time. Don't want to rush into things. Go to college, play sports. But, you know, when you're ready, you'll know. And then I thought I was ready after I began graduate school, following my undergraduate program. And during that time, I met the Jesuits, and I became a Jesuit, and I loved it. And I went through, you know, the first several years. I completed my one master's degree in the third year. And then I started theology, and I got approved to be ordained.
Why did you love the Jesuit thing? Was it the style of study? What was it?
It was the community, and it was the theological study that I think I'd always wanted to do. I wish I had been a religion major in college. I was an economics major.
Well, so do you think that you were born with that innate drive to understand the divinity or something like that?
I think that's always been part of my being, you know, part of on my mind, in my heart, part of my spirit. Yeah, I think from the time I was a little kid, I was conscious of something something other,
mm-hmm.
something with a capital O, I guess I would say, with a capital O.
So for a time, the Jesuit study responded to that in the community, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I loved it. I worked hard. Many guys went through and didn't work as hard as I did. I graduated with distinction, and I was approved to be ordained. And then all of a sudden, I realized, wait a minute, something's not right here. And I didn't know what it was. So I went back to the drawing board and began to ask myself the questions. What's wrong here? What's wrong with this picture? And it took me several years to sort it out. And the, you know, a leave of absence from the Jesuits and the, I have to say, thankfully, the support and encouragement of Jesuits who were interested in me finding my way to my true self.
Is that part of the Jesuit gift?
It is. It is. I think the Jesuit tradition derives from a man named St. Ignatius of Loyola, who developed what he called the discernment process. And what I was invited to do in my prayer and through the spiritual directors I worked with was to discern what was going on. Why was I hesitant to move ahead with ordination? And what was I being drawn to? And what was, you know, and living with that conflict over time and finally realizing that, you know, I needed to leave. You know, I wasn't going to rush ahead and be ordained just because I had reached the end of my theological studies. And fortunately, the Jesuits didn't nudge me that way, nor did my parents. And after a time of discernment and leave of absence, you know, I realized that on some level, still it was pretty much unconscious, but that I was trying to live out my father's dream for me, which was not my dream for myself. But I wanted to please my dad.
But part of it, that's sort of why I asked you about that innate thing. You still had the reach for divinity in there, didn't you?
Oh, that didn't leave, even with my signing out of the Jesuit order. No,
right.
No. That still remains pivotal in my life.
And that wasn't because of your dad. That was his way of framing what you could do with that.
Right. But my dad also had a deeply spiritual side to him.
Right. Okay.
Which I was greatly appreciative of, and as did my mom. And so I felt very much connected to it. In the way, you know, the fact that they were people of belief and faith, and but not in an extreme way. They were not extremists in their religious. They were just kind of quietly so, and in a way that was, I think, to me, very, very powerful in its influence.
So tell me this, and that's really wonderful, actually. A lot of us had a lot more controversy in our early childhood, but the conflict that you got into, do you think that's a really... I'm thinking that's a very valuable angst for people to go through in life, isn't it?
You mean in discerning what was going to be right for me?
Yeah, feeling not comfortable, until you come up with something, right?
Absolutely, and you know we don't want to confront that. I think it's anxiety provoking. It's fearful.
Mm-hmm. Shame-based sometimes.
Shame also is involved. Guilt, you know, all of those things are there.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe that if it's only by really striving, seeking to become who you really are and paying attention to, you know, the inside of your life as well as the outside, that you will get to that point where you can begin to live comfortably in the world.
Are you comfortable?
At the moment, except for the hip, I am more comfortable than I've ever been in my life.
I'm glad.
I'm more comfortable. And part of the comfort, I think, you know, Veronica, is, you know, not whereas earlier in my life I might have been inclined to run away from things that were fearful or anxiety provoking, I think I eventually turned around and just, you know, didn't run away from them.
Hmm.
So had to face them and had to grapple with, you know, what was getting stirred up and was that shame, should I have felt that shame or should I be guilty about that? And I began to discover that, no, you know, it wasn't so, you know, because I think a lot of it was some of the internalized image of God I had. You know, you've emphasized that I and are exactly right, that I still have a very strong sense of God in the world and God, you know, as an entity, a being.
Well, you have a wonderful story about how you encountered a kind of a mean priest, and he was being very autocratic, and it had a huge positive impact on you at some point. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yeah. No. I was, I went to confession because I always thought I was living in what we called in Catholicism mortal sin, which meant that if you died, you went to hell.
I know.
Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah.
And I remember going to this priest for confession. I was probably late adolescence. And so I'm in line, and there's a short line, and I get into the confessional, you know, and they close the door. His side slides open. He says, go ahead, or whatever. I forget the words he said. But so I started confessing, and he kept chipping away at me. He said, "You sure it was only three times? You sure it wasn't more? Only five, not more." And he kept going. And then I reached the end of my list. And he says, "Is that all? There must be more."
Wow.
And I was both scared and angry as hell.
Good, you're angry. Good.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad I was angry. I walked out and I looked, and the line that had been only a short line, because I was in that confessional for probably 15 minutes, and he was shouting. So they were hearing, and they must have wondered, what's going on? Then when I walked out, of course, I'm this altar boy in the church. You know, I'm sort of seen as a good boy.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people are sort of looking at me like, "God, what did he do?" And I remember the sense of, you know, shameful dread that came over me. But at that moment, I didn't quite make my breakthrough. I made it years later when I was praying one day, and I remember all of a sudden I had this image of this harsh, judgmental, unmerciful God. And I said to myself, why would I want to believe in that? Why would I want to live a life with that kind of shadow God hovering over me? And I remember raising my fist, I was pissed. And I said, if that's the kind of God you are, I don't even want you part of my life. And I said a few expletives.
Right.
And at that moment, all of a sudden, I had this sense of fear. Like, oh my God, what did I just do? And then I had the most profound sense of peace up to that point in my life I'd ever known.
Wow.
I felt calm. And all of a sudden, it was as if, you know, I was experiencing a sense of that's not who I am. You know, that is the other being, God. That's not who I am. And I got a quiet, wordless sense of that. And that was a real turning point for me. A real turning point. And you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of Catholics still live that way. And probably not just Catholics, but other religious traditions too.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of how wonderful Pope Francis is, you know, with his year of mercy. He's really saying, you know, we have to remember that God is first and foremost forgiving and merciful and loving.
Right.
You know? And to me, you know, that makes all the difference. And it helps me, it's helped me increasingly as I've made these breakthroughs. And it's helping me now as I'm approaching my 70th birthday.
I love it for you and for all of us, actually. So as you're really sharing with us many, many, like, for example, some of these questions lead us into who we are. Can you play with some of those questions for our listeners today?
Well, let's see.
There's 25 of them, so it's hard for me to decide which one to start with.
Yeah, well, maybe we can go at it from the point of view of what, you know, because the spirituality of age. You know, what is spirituality? I think our questions try to draw you into a deeper sense of spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of our questions address the issue of, you know, what are you awake? You know, are you awake?
And what does awake mean? That's such a commonly used word lately that I find myself always headed to some kind of imaginary glossary. So I go, right. Okay, what does awake mean to me? You know,
well,
I'm awake, not being cheeky. I'm exploring.
Yeah. No. Exactly. I think that actually the way we put it, it's that the first process in spirituality, the first dimension of it, is awakening. And I think what that means is, well put by someone a while ago in a book I read, you know, we sleepwalk through life. We really sleepwalk. You know, we react often, and we fashion our solutions to given situations totally through reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't necessarily fashion our responses to situations. You know, we have the ability to respond, and we also have what I call the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to really, you know, consider mind, heart, body, spirit. You know, all those aspects of self. What is my response going to be? Because if I just react, I'm going to develop a formulaic response to life's issues and questions.
Mm-hmm.
And and my reaction is produced because of my fear, my anxiety, my dread, all those things that create reactions. Like when you're out walking at night and you hear howling and you're hiking in the woods. You know, oh my God, what is that? So I react, and all of a sudden I'm in fear, and I just have to figure, well, what am I going to do? But I don't really say, okay, well, you know, it's probably nothing, or it's not as big as it seems. So I think awakening is really snapping out of the reactive mode.
Is it anything like going into that still place that really, that you just talked about, finding the divinity in that still place, or finding God, if you will, or
I think that maybe the stillness is the fruit of the awakening.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking while you talk. That's great.
Yeah, it's kind of all of a sudden you go, wait a minute, you know, I'm not gonna this, the solution I've come up with, the reactive solution I've come up with in my life, is not going to remain and keep me imprisoned. I have options. I can think more out of the box and get myself out of the box. you know. But most of us, because we're accustomed to the way it is, you know, we stay in the box. And I think what we invite people to do is consider, you know, what awakening really is.
Mm-hmm.
So asking people to think about that. What have you awakened to?
Well, you and I talked yesterday, and we talked about the three grand delusions most of us share until we don't, which may also be a clue into awakening. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
You're right on point there, Veronica. I think the three grand delusions are, and that's the second point of spirituality. You know, it's first of all awakening and then getting rid of illusions.
Okay.
So when you start to awaken, you see the illusions. And I've certainly, in my recent life, in my aging recent life, had to confront the three grand illusions you mentioned. And they are, first of all, immortality, the illusion of immortality. The second is the illusion of invulnerability. The third is the illusion of complete independence.
Mm.
You know, those are the illusions that we all have. And our culture, American culture in particular, fosters that sense. You know, we don't want to think about death. Even now, when I go to a funeral, they invite you to walk away from the grave before the casket is lowered. Because when it's lowered, you really get a sense of it's over. A person was mortal. But now, you know, people don't want to deal with, you know, parents or kids jumping in after their deceased parents in the grave. You know, so they try to pretty up the whole funeral process. And when I was a kid, you know, we would be there and watch the coffin go in, and we would shovel dirt on it. Each of us would do a small shovel full of dirt on the coffin.
Did you like that as a child?
You know, it did not scare me for some reason, and that was because of my mom. But I think, you know, I was aware of how fearful people would become. And when I saw people, you know, crying and leaping in and screaming and, you know, and it didn't, for some reason, I don't know, it was just, you know, it was saying goodbye to somebody. Like my neighbor, when he died and I visited, I said goodbye to him at his home and then at his funeral. You know, he was laid out in his home. That's before funeral homes. And, you know, to me, it was not scary. But
it isn't scary if you're brought up with it in a kind of a tribal sense, is it?
No, exactly. I think if our parents are comfortable with it, or those who really are primary caregivers, then we can move with it. So we have to confront, you know, our mortality, yeah. Which is, you know, I know I'm going to die someday. I mean, you know, everybody who's listening to this program knows that. But even when I say that, probably some people are going, you know, are probably wanting to shut off the recording, you know?
Oh, I told you that I often say in a group of people, you know, we don't get out of this alive. And invariably somebody goes,
oh! right.
And I laugh. I go, we're so naive because we block reality.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's the, you know, the invulnerability illusion. And, you know, with my hip now, I am confronting the, you know, vulnerability reality, not the illusion of invulnerability, but the reality of vulnerability. And then...
And how does that feel outside of physical?
How does that feel?
Yeah.
You know, I have grown increasingly comfortable with the reality of that I am, I have limitations.
Okay.
That, you know, I think we spoke a little earlier about the shame issue, and I think I've moved beyond that. What I want to be for people is an example of the way you can live with and bear it, not in a sort of I'm a warrior sense or I'm a, you know, look how heroic I am, but I'm a human being like you.
Right.
And we all have to, I think at a certain point, learn how to bear it and look for how it can grow us in new ways. And that is really one of the points of our main overriding themes of our book is how can facing the light and the shadow side of aging, how can asking questions about the shadow side as well, in a sense, help grow you into a new, maybe even more true self that you are?
So sometimes it's examining these illusions, or not examining them, but facing mortality and immortality, right?
Exactly.
It really helps you I'm thinking about helping you to be purer about your identity. What is your identity? This is a big, complicated question, I think, but what is our identity? Is it a very deep inner place with themes of its own? It's not really external in a lot of ways, is it?
No, I think that, you know, the clothes I wear, you know, because I've learned that's a mode I'm comfortable with, or, you know, the things I enjoy. It really is a much deeper sense. I think that it's the truest self inside is deep and almost, and I think it's so much like, you know, in the Bible, Old and New Testament, there's the notion of the humankind being fashioned in the image of God. So at its deepest level, the real self is, in a sense, a manifestation of that which is divine. You know, that which is divine. And that which is divine, you know, at least in Christian tradition, also came and took on mortality.
Hmm.
You know, died. And yes, life continued, because that's the nature of the divinity. You know, and the intention for all of us, at least in my belief system, and that's pretty profound.
How do we work with people, or how, you work with some people who are basically totally debilitated? Do you?
My practice is a private practice, and because of all kinds of, you know, accessibility questions and issues, you know, most people are not. No, I have worked with people in settings where that is the case. But I think the debilitations that I work with are more internal now, not necessarily physical or related to age at times, you know, I not wanting to face the getting older process.
I think I was reading some of the comments made by, or some of the essays written by Dr. Orsborn. I think it was her writings that included kind of sort of an inventory, sort of developing more of an inventory attitude to your life. Have I, how's my relationship with my adult children? How is, you know, people, you want to talk about that kind of thing? Forgivenesses or unhooking from things?
Well, I'm remembering actually one of the moments when I was a Jesuit. You know what it's called? There was a guy named Robert Butler, who was a wonderful, wonderful physician who founded the National Institute on Aging, actually, and he died about 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And Butler's developed this concept way back in the 60s called life review.
Oh, yeah, I love that.
And others have picked up on, I think, what you're talking about in Carol's, in regard to Carol, as a manifestation of that. It's looking at your life at each juncture and sort of saying, well, you know, how is it for, you know, am I being true to myself? Am I being true to myself? And I remember when I was a hospital chaplain, I spent a lot of time on the oncology services.
Oh, my.
You know, visited a lot of people, some of whom were discharged with the remissions, some of whom died. You know, I was with people who died at times. And I remember this one gentleman in particular. The first time I walked in, I had my Jesuit collar on, you know, the old black with the white up top.
All right.
And I look in his room, and he's sitting there, and I said, hello, may I come in? He says, nah, get lost.
Great.
So I said, okay, maybe another time. And I left. And I think it was a day or two later, I walked back and he was there sitting in his hospital, you know, bed or chair. I can't remember now. But I looked in, I said, good day. I said, he said, you got a moment? I said, yeah, sure. So I walked in. So he invited me in. And I listened to him. I didn't, you know, say, shall we pray this or let's do that. I didn't say, you know, ask him a series of questions. But he was doing kind of a life review, which he made me aware of. He was sitting there saying, you know, it was almost like he needed to tell somebody. He said, you know, I think my wife would say, you know, Joe was a good husband. You know, you could count on. He was there. And then he said, and my kids, they would probably say, you know, Daddy was there for us. You know, he took care of us. This man was like 52 or 53 years old.
Oh, wow. That's not very old, is it?
No. And he said, you know, and my kids, they'd say, yeah, your dad was a good guy. And he just went down the list of things like that. You mentioned Carol's lists. He went down the list, and he was able to affirm the life he had lived, in a sense, and the legacy his kids and his spouse and the family at large would have even after his death. He did die. He had a very, very advanced case of cancer and a huge, huge tumor which was being radiated. But he did die. But I'll never forget him. And because of his candor about himself, you know, he could say no when he wanted to, like get lost, you know, but when he wanted to say yes, it was there. And I said, that's the kind of people I want, you know, that's the kind of, I can relate to that kind of man.
Yeah.
You know, he can say yes, he can say no.
Because you're allowing him to be really who he is, and you're hearing him, seeing him, being there, right? Because I think we need each other. You talked about the three illusions, and one of them is independence, right?
Oh, yes.
Let's link that one in, because I feel like the way you heard him was a hugely community kind of gift.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think our culture, you know, in America is really encourages, and even more these days, you know, what's going to make, you know, us great again. And a lot of it still has the old thing of, you know, you'd be able to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Well, you
put
know,
a chicken life, in every pot.
That's right. You know, and but what really, you know, none of us from the time we are conceived, none of us has ever been or will ever be completely independent. You know, and I remember.
That is a thought for me that I really need to ponder.
Yeah, I remember, you know, in my run-up to marriage after I left the Jesuits, I remember going through a stretch where I thought to myself, I don't ever want to need anybody. I actually felt that. And I remember talking with a dear friend of mine. I was visiting her and her husband and her family, three daughters, and we stayed up late one night, she and I said to her, we were talking, and somehow I blurted out at one point, I don't want to ever need anybody. And that was when it dawned on me where I was and how I was stuck, because I saw her sitting there listening intently to me, and we were very much in connection. And then when I said those words, she backed away from me.
Oh my.
It was all body language. And I looked at her and I realized what my stance, which I was somewhat conscious of, but mostly unconscious of, what my stance was doing to my connection to others.
Oh, that's very interesting. Huh?
And that woke me up. That was an awakening. And I got rid of the illusion of independence, or at least I started to shed it at that point. And that moved me to the point of being enabled to move ahead in marriage and really saying, no, I need somebody and I am needed. So what happens when
and I belong. Isn't there something about belonging in there?
Oh, absolutely. I do a lot of group therapy, and that's one of the first curative factors in group therapy is a sense of belonging.
Okay.
We all need that. That's empirically evident, you know, that's needed. But so often we are afraid of it. We are afraid that we will lose ourselves. We will become submissive. So, you know what?
Or once again, we'll be wearing the status quo coming from whatever the group is, sort of thing.
That's right. That's right. Mm. But you know what? What are the gifts that come when those illusions, when you manage to begin to shed those illusions of immortality, invulnerability, and independence? You know, for me, the gifts are, you know, let's start with independence to dependence. I am interdependent. And what the gift I have now is much more of a sense of community. You know, as we've gone through some difficult times around health, my health, you know, friends have made us meals. Friends have called. Friends have come over. Friends have called. And, you know, and I'm feeling like I'm held by this community. And we all need to be held and to belong. What about moving from invulnerability to vulnerability? I think what's happened there for me is compassion. As I have had to face my own vulnerability, I cannot try to push away others whose vulnerability scares me. All of a sudden, I can.
So that's like a homeless person sitting on the street, or
like you name it—a homeless person sitting on the street, someone who's, you know, pushing himself in a wheelchair, you know, missing a leg, you know, whatever it is. all of a sudden, I and they, you know, we're part of the same human community. And the mortality piece, I think I think I've gotten as a gift from there is a more profound sense of courage. You know, once you start to look that which is most frightening, and, you know, all of us have a bit of the Cleopatra in us, you know, queen of denial. You know, denial of death is such a potent force. But when you look at it, what it opens up is your life. I just last night saw a friend of mine who's gone through some very, very, serious cancer, and it's doing fine now. But you could see the effects, you know, the alopecia, the loss of hair and all of that. And what she said is, what it's done for me is it's encouraged me to live every moment fully. You know, and if you don't want to look at that, you may be actually shortchanging yourself on living in the moment that is. So for me, it's given me courage, I think, to face my mortality. And also, in a funny thing, and people may not believe this when they hear me say this, you know, a sense of comfort, because I've been able to relax more and just take what I've got right now, our conversation right now, Veronica, and enjoy this.
Mm-hmm. Because it's not a drive to achieve or to amount to something or to be successful or... Those things, I think, really take our attention for how many years? Many years.
Oh, it was with me when I was awaiting our connection by phone today, you know. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, is it going to be good? Am I going to be, you know, whatever? Wait a minute. This is just about being yourself.
But isn't this wonderful that you're talking about this to all these wonderful listeners, too?
I hope at least one person out there takes some of this in, and that it alters the way you perceive the world. Maybe this is like a kind of like cataract surgery, you know. I've had cataract surgery too, so, you know, it, for both eyes. And what I discovered was, you know, I thought, oh my God, I got to go through that. And beforehand, of course, all the cloudiness was there.
Right.
When I had the cataract surgery, I could not believe that my eyes were the acuity of vision in my eyes was sharper than I could ever remember.
Wow.
I could see things so clearly and sharply, and I write about this in the book, but also the colors were much brighter than ever I could remember.
But you might not have noticed the value of colors so much before, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. The color, you know, the color of a person's laughter, even, you know, the beauty of an autumn with the changing foliage. But just seeing another person and just seeing them very sharply and clearly. So I think there's sort of a metaphor of, you know, maybe spiritually awakening and getting rid of illusions is like having spiritual cataract surgery.
Wow, I like that a lot. So awakening is actually being able to be in the very moment with the wonders around us, which have been blocked. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but also, and this is kind of the third dimension of spirituality, it enables you to be freer in the context of all those things. You know, and what does freedom mean? I think
that's a good question. What does freedom mean?
Well, I think freedom is, well, let me see. Let me see if I can maybe find a little piece here.
Spell that word peace for me, Bob.
P-E-A-C-E.
Good job.
Here we go. And this was in the intro to our section on one of the sections of our book, What is Freedom?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember which one of us wrote this. I think Carol was the lead on this, and we sort of then, you know, did some editing together. But here it goes, the last paragraph of the intro. To accomplish inner freedom, it is impingent upon us to find the courage and strength to walk a path through the ebbing tide of the changes in our lives and times by deepening our spirituality, dismantling the illusions of escape, and thereby strengthening ourselves for the challenges ahead. This will not be easy. However, with the solid anchorage of a spiritual life, further developed by the very fact of aging and the unique conditions of your own aging process, you always have the potential to come alive again in unimaginable ways easily obscured by fear, anxiety, and the alternative illusions that denial encourages. It is always possible, regardless of the circumstances you face, to claim your inalienable right to be free.
Oh, wow.
So that's actually very profound. So I'm going, okay, that's a real freedom from that jail we spoke of earlier, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, and it's freedom so that nothing impinges on you the way, you know, for example, you know, family conflicts are not unusual. You know, in fact, in all my years, I've never met a fully functional family. You know, I think every family has a certain dysfunctionality in it, and that could work to the good.
What's that old line? Put the fun back into dysfunctional.
You know, but yeah, it's you know, those unforgiven people in our lives and the family who hurt us once, and you know, it's 40 years later, and we're still angry with them, but we don't even remember why we got angry at them in the first place.
Right. But that, you know, lets that person be the family scapegoat, right?
Right. That's one way to one purpose that a person like that can serve in the family. But yeah, it's really about, I think, not being at the mercy of any person, thing, or event.
Hmm.
You know, like being free of, not at the mercy of the prospect that I will die someday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's another kind of freedom, which I think, you know, I've been able to enjoy. I think we were talking about my mother in that regard recently.
Yes, I'd like you to speak more about your mother, because she was a very profound being.
Yeah, no, she, my mother was, her name was Mary, and she was a very quiet woman, not the most emotionally demonstrative, but she was there. You knew she was there. And when I was about 11 years old, I encountered for the first time ever a really profound sense that my parents could die.
Ah.
It was triggered by a program I was watching on TV. But the result of watching that program was I got depressed. I think I truly was experiencing a particular kind of depression at that point. And I moped and moped for about 2 weeks. And my mother kept nudging me and saying...
How old were you, 7?
11.
Oh, 11. Okay.
Yep. I think I was 11 years old when that occurred. And she said, so what's... You know, what's wrong? Tell me. I said, nothing. You know, tough little boy. And finally, after a couple of weeks, after many attempts on her part to get me to say what was going on, I did. I stopped and she said, sit down, tell me what's going on. And I looked her in the eye and I burst into tears. Yeah. And I sobbed and sobbed these deep, I'd never sobbed so deeply in my life, I think, up to that point. And she just looked at me and I said, you're going to die. You're going to die. And it was scaring me that she could die. And my mother she sat there and then she put her hand on my shoulder. And I looked up at her and she said, that's true. Someday I am going to die. You know, and of course a certain twinge of fear emerged because I guess, you know, she didn't say the way we might be inclined. Some people might be inclined to say, oh, don't worry about that now.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't. She said, I am going to someday.
Hmm.
Then she added, but you know what? Probably not for a while. And that was true, too. She died, I think it was 35 years later.
Hmm.
You know, so I was 11. I was 46 when she died. Would that be about right? Yep. 46, yep.
Mm-hmm.
And then she added, and this is what I continue to live out of my life. She said, so in the meantime... In the time between now and then, why don't you go out and play with your friends?
That's really wonderful, right?
That, you know, she so soothed me, but not by averting reality.
But wait a minute, did you have any more grief about that? Did you ever have grief about her potential passing or other people's?
I'm sure I did at moments, you know, and both my parents have died, you know, my father in 1984, my mother in 1992.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are certainly moments when I probably had some dread resurface. But that encouragement, again, encouragement in the face of mortality, you know, she helped me to adopt a way of living that is, go out in the meantime between now and the end, whether it's your end or the end of someone you love, go out and play together.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of play. If we can do that today, you know, we would then, I think, we older folks who are closer to that, you know, than others are, although, you know, you don't know, you know, when it's going to happen. You know, I have friends who died when they were in high school.
I was widowed at 32. Yeah.
At 32. Mm-hmm. So, you know what that's like. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, but I wanted to say something about when people have crossed over, when you know, and the older we get, and I'm in my 70s, we've lost a number of people by now. And the things that I really revere in looking back are just what you're saying, laughing with them. That was the best joke exchange I ever had way back when, and blah, blah, blah. You know, you just like, it's not usually about whether they wrote a great book or whether they won an election or, you know, it's usually about how it made me feel to be with them or share time or, you know.
Yes.
She was right. Did you play with her? Was she a good person to play with, your mom?
She was not a woman who played well, no. She was a good mom in the sense of being there, making sure everything was taken care of, the food was cooked. She was not a play. My father was a playful person.
Mm.
I could play with him. So fortunately, you know, they sort of balanced each other off. My mother was a little more reserved. My father was a little more out there. And I think that the blend, I think, worked for me. It worked for me.
Well, talking about blend, because we're going to have to end this soon, but I could talk to you for hours. You're very, very interesting.
I could talk with you for hours, too. I enjoy this with you.
Me, too. But also, I was just thinking about couples. So we have blending. You were speaking of blending, and I'm going, well, what happens with a couple when somebody's aging and is much more decrepit and so on, the other one becomes a caretaker and, you know, back and forth like that. I watch people really struggle with that. I watch people feel sick about that. I watch people feel courageous about that. I just wonder what you have to say about it. Any advice or recommendations for our listeners?
Well, I'm actually, my wife and I are getting practice on that right now because of my hip. I'm due to have surgery at the end of June. So I'm going to have to live with a state of decrepitude to, you know, and again, I'm going to be able to work and that's not an issue, but you know, we can't do the things. I can't go for long walks with her, or I can't take the dog out for a long walk. And, you know, vacations are more restrictive right now. So we're, you know, until this is over. So it's hit us. And I've been very conscious of, you know, trying to make it as easy as possible and doing whatever I can, but also being very willing to accept from her what, you know, she can give. And, you know, I guess when a lot of people get to the point of, you know, experiencing some decrepitude, they often become bitter.
Yeah, exactly.
They become resentful. And then, you know, it's often taken out on the caretaker who's most prominent.
Right. Or else the caretaker becomes bitter and takes it out on the patient.
Because I've seen
all those different things.
It's a turbulent, it can be an extremely turbulent and conflictual time. And
but tell me this, is it because that we have to go, if we're caretaking or if we're the decrepit one for this period, do we really have to look at ourselves again and examine the identity? Like, my identity isn't just to look after you. That's not who
that's
I am.
Right.
You know, we have to look at that, don't we? Because the identity has to be able to, as far as I understand, in self-inquiry, your identity has to be able to be flexible and move around, doesn't it? Isn't that part of aging?
It is. And I think what I'm trying to do, what my wife and I are trying to do, it's not that we don't have our moments when, you know, tensions build. But I said to her, I said, I know what you need. She's a cabaret singer.
How wonderful.
And, you know, like on Wednesday night this week, she's going to go to an open mic and sing. And I won't go with her. But I said, look, you need that for yourself. You go, you know, feed yourself too, not just me. And she's going to a 4-day conference on cabaret singing before my surgery in June, you know, because she needs to. And I know that.
And well, you're talking about self-expression, right?
Yes.
And it sounds like you could write while you're debilitated, right?
I'm working on it. Yeah, I'm actually working on a book. I'm thinking about taking my Jesuit background and apply some of the Ignatian, so-called Ignatian spirituality, Saint Ignatius's spirituality, in a time of illness and in a time of.
Oh, we don't have time to talk about him, but I wanted to. Maybe I'll call you for an interview whilst you're recuperating. But the story of Saint Ignatius and his recovery is brilliant, actually.
It's an amazing story, and it's an inspiration to me.
Yeah, I guess we haven't got time to recap it. It'll get cut out. But I've really enjoyed talking to you, Dr. Robert Weber, and The Spirituality of Aging, Guidebook for Seekers. I love that, actually. It's a great book and really inspiring for people.
And, you know, people can get a taste of it on our website if they want to get some excerpts and get a sense of it and comments about it. It's www.spiritualityofage.com.
Okay, and now are the 25 questions there?
They are.
Yeah, because we didn't get to the questions because we've had a pretty rich flow already, but some of those questions I thought I'm going to sit down with a paper and pen or a computer and go through them all for myself, especially the ones we get to Who Am I, that section.
Yes.
I think that could really help people.
Well, people can get a taste of the book there.
Good. I'm really appreciative of that. And thank you so much. And look after yourself. And thanks for looking after us.
And thank you for the invitation to converse with you today.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. You can be in touch with me, veronicaentwistle.com. And as you heard from Dr. Weber, you can be in touch with him on his website, which is thespiritualityofage.com. Thank you so much for listening. Your feedback is gratefully received. Many blessings.